Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Imagine waking up day after day to a blood-red dawn. Or imagine fire raining down on you as you flee towards the ocean, your only place of safety. Or imagine, just try, 1 billion animals dead across the nation from fires that burn and burn and burn for months on end. Now, of course, these are the hellish scenarios that do not defy imagination because they are reality for the people of Australia right now. Historic bushfires engulfing parts of the country, a prime minister on the defensive for his lackluster response, and Australia, which just experienced its hottest and driest year on record, looking forward to a future where mega fires like these may become more common. So this hour on Point, Australia, historic bushfires, and climate change. And you can join us if you have friends or family who are in Australia. Have you been in touch with them? What are they seeing? What is life like now with these bushfires? What do you think can be done in the face of devastating climate change, which may bring more years, more dry, hot years like this to nations around the world? Join us online at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're going to begin today in Sydney, Australia, with the New York Times Australia Bureau reporter Isabella Kwai. Isabella, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
I also want to acknowledge that it's quite a late hour there for you, so I'm doubly grateful. First of all, Isabella, just give us a sense right now about sort of how large, how devastating these fires currently are.
Right. So these fires have been burning since September of this year, which is essentially our winter. And, you know, these fire seasons are getting longer and longer as time goes on. So far, they've destroyed over 2,000 homes. They've sadly killed at least 24 people. And the area that has burnt and is burning is increasing by the day. So, it's at least 14 million acres at this point, larger than countries like Denmark. The estimate of how many animals have been killed is now ecologists are saying it could be a billion animals, which means that many of them are probably on the edge of extinction, if not extinct. So it really is, a terrifying thing for Australians to process and probably Australians living all across the world. We aren't strangers to bushfires. Mm. We grow up knowing that we live on the most arid continent on Earth, but it has never been so dry and so hot before in the country, and so many fires burning at the same time. So I think many people here are processing the aftermath of something that they thought would be perhaps further in the future.
Right. Well, let's listen to a moment from an interview from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. This is a Budgong, New South Wales resident, describing how he tried to fight the bushfires as they overtook his small farm.
So I ran around like a blue-ass fly, sprinklers everywhere, hose and everything, spot fires happening everywhere. And the next thing had come from the west, it come flying up through here, and it was like World War III.
Like World War III. I mean, Isabella, is that how it has felt like? Just this conflagration everywhere?
Oh, I certainly think that some of the stories I've heard from people have been quite apocalyptic. The fires have sort of approached at various times. There have been warnings. And for many people in the towns that are in the danger zone, some of them that have been affected, they're running out of food, they're running out of water. If there's only one road in or out of the town and that gets cut off, there are towns like Mallacoota in Victoria that were stranded for many, many days. Telecommunications were down for a while. One person told me that, cash is the only thing stores were accepting because obviously the card machines are down. So it's one of those realities that, you know, in this modern age, we probably don't think about, but the bushfires have led to a situation where people are imagining a future where the way of life in itself could be threatened in some of the areas in this country.
All right. So let's then talk about, there's so much to dig into, but let's talk about the response from the Australian government. I mean, specifically from Prime Minister Scott Morrison. I see that he has just called for a government inquiry into his own government's response to the fires. Can you tell us more?
Yes. So I think it really began in about mid-December. The Prime Minister was on a holiday in Hawaii, and this is while, you know, the fires were still burning, and many people were very upset about this. You know, they felt that this showed he wasn't taking the bushfires seriously. And then, you know, the tragic news came that two firefighters had died while battling a huge blaze, and they were the first firefighter deaths in this season. And that, amongst other news, brought the Prime Minister to cut his holiday short. But in the meantime, you know, I think part of the damage was done. The people that I've spoken to, many of them are very upset because they feel that we were warned by fire officials and experts that this season was going to be very, very bad, possibly unprecedented, and that the government, knowing this, did not act to prevent and rather waited until the situation had become untenable to and is now playing catch up in a way. In one town, residents heckled the Prime Minister out when he visited, asking him why he had not diverted resources to them earlier. So there is this building feeling here, which is complicated by the fact that we had an election last year, and people were quite surprised that this current government was voted in because they aren't as strong on climate change policy.
Well, let's listen to how to some of the criticism that Prime Minister Morrison has been facing. On January 6th, during a televised interview on Sky News, Australian Green Party leader Richard Di Natale criticized Prime Minister Morrison, and he said that the Prime Minister had been ignoring warnings, Isabella, to your point, and failed to keep the people of Australia safe.
We were warned about this many, many months ago by fire chiefs, and the Prime Minister effectively gave them the middle finger and said, I'm not meeting with you. He was derelict in his responsibility to keep the country safe and tried to fob this off onto the states. This isn't a state issue. This is a national crisis.
Now, Isabella, when Di Natale says tried to fob this off onto the states, does that mean that, is he referencing Morrison saying that the immediate responsibility for firefighting was on the various different states of Australia, not the federal government?
Right. So traditionally, firefighting has been a state-by-state issue. Every state has its own service. And in fact, you know, many of the firefighters that work in the rural areas are volunteer firefighters, which signals perhaps what it was like previously to live in a country where you did have fires, but they weren't so all-consuming. Now, the Prime Minister has said, look, this has said previously, look, this is an issue for the states. We've never really had an all federal response. But that comment is what has gotten him into trouble, because we are at a point where people are looking for a national leadership on this issue. It's affected thousands and thousands of people, you know, homes lost. Projected estimates by, you know, one bank is that it'll be $5 billion in losses. And, you know, I think this calling of an inquiry, you know, and also the beginning of a fund to provide some of this disaster relief by the Prime Minister is a way to address these concerns by the people. But the question is this a turning point for Australians? Has this whole summer showed them that it is the time to vote on climate change policy? We've still got 2 years left of this government, but at least my sense of it from my reporting is there is this fear, anxiety, and dread from people. that wasn't there before in this capacity about what the future of this country looks like and whether this way of life we have can go on.
Well, let's listen to how the Prime Minister himself has been responding to this issue of climate change being an underlying force in these devastating bushfires. He visited Kangaroo Island, fire damage locations on Kangaroo Island not that long ago. And here's Prime Minister Morrison saying that his government is trying to focus regarding climate change on balancing Australian economic interests with emissions goals.
What we will do is ensure that our policies remain sensible, that they don't move towards either extreme, and stay focused on what Australians need for a vibrant and viable economy, as well as a vibrant and sustainable environment. Getting the balance right is what Australia, I think, has always been able to achieve. But right now, the focus, as I said at the outset, is to fight these fires and to get people to safety.
That's Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. I mean, Isabella, let's just underscore a truth here. Prime Minister Morrison is a very vociferous supporter of the large coal industry in Australia. So how much of that is informing his ongoing response to this devastation that's happening in Australia?
Oh, right. I mean, he's very infamous for bringing a lump of coal into Parliament and telling people, don't be scared. It's just coal. It won't hurt you. The Australian economy is built in a sense on coal exports. It's one of the largest exports in the country. The fossil fuels industry has huge lobbying power. So the government has always succeeded by taking this line that, our economy is what's important. And now I think they're balancing these new concerns from people. And Morrison, I think, is trying to still keep that balance. Yeah. And I don't know whether he fully comprehends that perhaps the tipping point is shifting and the climate change concerns may outweigh those of the economy.
Well, Isabella Kwai is the Sydney-based reporter for The New York Times. Sydney, Isabella, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Australia's ongoing historic bushfires and lessons for the rest of the world as that nation tries to cope. Let's listen to the voice of another Australian here, because some residents in New South Wales have been forced to evacuate. And in an interview with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, one evacuee who was taken to the waterfront town of Eden said she'd lost everything.
My house is at Kaya, which is about 20 kilometres south of Eden. And my neighbour stayed to defend his property. And I didn't stay there. I evacuated. And he contacted me this morning to say, sorry, but my house is gone.
That's a resident of New South Wales talking to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Well, obviously the human impact is quite devastating, but so is the impact to Australia's natural environment as well. So we want to talk about that and the issue of climate change as well. So joining us now from Canberra, Australia, is Peter Kanowski. He's a professor of forestry at the Australian National University's Fenner School of Environment and Society. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Pleasure to join you.
And again, thank you so much, given the hour that it is, the wee hours that it is there in Australia. I'm also joined now by Alistair Melzer. He's joining us from Rockhampton, Australia. He's research program leader for koala research at Central Queensland University. He studied Australian koala populations since 1989. Alistair, welcome to you.
Hello.
So, Alistair, if I may start with you, we have, around the world, we've been hearing these numbers of possibly a billion animals perishing thus far in these bushfires. It's almost hard to, it's hard to contemplate what that number means. A billion animals? Tell us more.
Well, the fires have been effectively continent-wide, but in varying intensities. But where the fires have been intense, there's been a loss of all wildlife, pretty much. So there's huge numbers of the smaller animals, the things people don't think about, the reptiles, the amphibians, of course, all the invertebrates, as well as the more charismatic animals, such as the glider opossums, the koalas, and anything that's hollow-dwelling will have lost much of their habitat in those more intense parts of the landscape.
So how are the koalas doing?
There have been local extinctions. There's been a lot of animals that have been injured either by fire or by smoke inhalation. And there have been a lot more that have been affected by the post-fire environment. Because koalas are dependent on the foliage on trees for food and water, once a fire goes through, often a quite mild fire goes through, it can desiccate the canopy of the eucalypt trees upon which it depends. So the surviving koalas then have a famine after the fire. So one, they survive the fire, but then two, they've got to try and find resources. So it's a complex impact on a population, which will last quite some time. But as I said, in many areas where the fires are particularly hot, that's particularly in southern Australia, in New South Wales, Victoria, and on South Australia's Kangaroo Island, for example, the intense fires just kill large numbers of those animals.
So hearing you say that that a lot of these animals face a famine after the fire, and the fires themselves are going to go on for more months ahead of you. I mean, Australia is home to so many species that are found nowhere else on planet Earth. Are we looking at the possibility of total extinction of certain Australian species?
It depends on the species and its nature. So, for example, the koala is not going to be rendered extinct by these fires because it's got a continent-wide north-south distribution, and there are many areas of forest that haven't burnt, and there'll be many areas of forest where the fires were mild enough that many koalas survived. But where animals have limited distributions, so things like some of the reptiles, some of the specialist mammals and the like, they will have had nowhere to go, and there's a good chance that some of those have been lost. But we don't know for sure until we can do the post-fire assessments, and the Commonwealth and the states are gearing up to do that right now. Mm. And then if you're an animal that has a specialist habitat requirement, for example, one that requires tree hollows that take 100 years or more to develop, then even if you survive the fire, there is no habitat for you to come back to. So you're stuck, you're vulnerable to, obviously, to the famine after the fire, but also you're vulnerable to predation by native and exotic predators such as cats and foxes.
Mm. Now, Alistair, if I may, I just have to return to this because, again, it's just hard to really get a detailed sense as to what the loss of 1 billion animals means? I mean, is that a significant percentage of the animals in Australia? Are we looking at major holes now, major holes in various ecosystems across the continent?
First of all, the number 1 billion is an estimate. It has to be because right. It's not possible to fully census the Australian fauna, given the scale of the landscape we're talking about.
Right.
But also the cryptic nature of many of these animals, even koalas, estimates of populations. Population densities or absolute numbers are crude at best, simply because of that scale issue and the logistics associated with working in very rugged environments. Despite that, some of these landscapes will have a significant loss of fauna for quite some time. Assuming that some animals have survived the fire in what we call fire refuge, then there will be a period where those burnt landscapes will be empty of those fauna until such time as, first of all, the landscape can recover post-fire, and then the surviving populations can build up and expand into those areas. But you have to remember, and I'm sure this will be spoken about soon,
mm-hmm.
these fires are a consequence of the background intense, almost continent-wide drought we're suffering at the moment as well. And that drought environment, the water deficits and the heat waves, etc., is going to affect the way in which the forests recover. It's forest and grasslands, by the way, and heathlands. It's a complex of vegetation. But their post-fire recovery will be determined by a lot of things, including the environment.
Mm.
And so that rate of recovery will be affected by the underlying drought. It's been going on for some time. In some parts of the country, it's been going on for years. And also the capacity of the surviving wildlife to reproduce, the rate at which they do it, will also be influenced by those environmental stresses.
Yes.
We know, for example, in some koala populations that the rate of reproduction in koalas slows down during a drought. So the fires are the ghastly consequence of this underlying drought.
Mm.
We have a short-term catastrophic effect, but we still have the drought after this as well, and that's going to affect the rate of recovery.
Right. Well, Alistair, you're exactly right, because we want to talk more deeply about, again, the background of how Australia got to where it is right now. And Peter, I appreciate your patience very much. Peter's a professor of forestry at the Australian National University's Fenner School of Environment and Society. We've been reading, Peter, that Australia has experienced its hottest and driest year on record. How much hotter has it been than normal?
Yes, that's correct, Meghna. It's been daytime temperatures have been an average of 2 degrees above the long-term average, which is set between 1961 and 1990. The nighttime temperatures have been a bit warmer, but not quite as much. So the overall average in 2019 was 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about 3 degrees Fahrenheit more than the long-term average. And as Alice has just said, that's coupled across Australia, but most pronounced in the more southerly parts of Australia. With a very severe drought, it's been the driest driest year on record as well, the rainfall's perhaps nearly a third less than the next most driest year, which was more than 100 years ago. So that gives you some sense of the extent of the drought and the heat wave that we've been experiencing and are continuing to experience.
So if I may, just the rainfall has been one third less than the next driest year in Australia, which occurred, you said, a century ago.
That's correct. Australia's got a very variable climate, and one of the reasons that it's been hard for some Australians to appreciate this underlying trend that Alistair mentioned is that we, in the absence of climate change, we have a very variable climate. We have long cycle droughts. So Australians know about the Federation drought, we call it, back in the start of the 20th century, more than 100 years ago, which is a very protracted, severe drought. We had another very severe, protracted drought around the turn of the 21st century and into its first decade. And we had some lesser droughts in the 1930s and the 1950s, for example, in different parts of Australia. So our climate naturally is very variable. But what we're seeing is this heating and drying trend, particularly across southern Australia, superimposed on that natural pattern of variability. And so that means that the extremes are becoming more extreme, particularly the heat extremes and the drought extremes. And that trend is anticipated to continue as global greenhouse gas concentrations continue to rise.
Well, there's a lot more to dig into here, but Peter and Alistair, if you could just stand by for a moment. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's go to Peggy, who's calling from Williston, Vermont. Peggy, you're on the air.
Yes, I have friends in Australia, so the information I get from them is personal. You know, it's boots on the ground type information. My friend north of Sydney said that he was measuring cracks in his lawn that were an inch and a half wide and 8 inches deep. He said the dryness has just made his lawn almost unlivable. The grass around the pictures that he sent me was just, they were all, it was just all brown. There was no green grass. And then he sent me a picture of him water. He was giving water to a little, some kind of little dragon, looked like about a foot long, some little amphibian. The other thing is that the air quality, David said the air quality there is just absolutely horrendous. He said it's worse than, you know, spending a night in a bar. He said he went down to just get his mail and come back, and he was just coughing by the time he got back. And my friends are all in different parts of Australia, Perth, Victoria. Mm-hmm. So it's not just in one place. So,
right.
The boots on the ground type thing, it's really affecting the health of some of these people, too.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for your call. I mean, on that air quality note, some of the smoke we're seeing is reportedly now reaching New Zealand as well. Let's go to Reggie, who's calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Reggie, you're on the air.
Hi. I listen to NPR a lot, and I always... my first time even making a call like this, and I just wanted to just say to everybody that I think that with these fires coming up and all these talks of climate change, is that I really do think that we're just going to keep seeing this more and more and more, and it's time to start asking ourselves, well, what are we going to do about it? Because like, this isn't stopping. The Australian fires have lasted for months now. I've heard about Nice, Italy, and how they're experiencing record flooding that typically only happened every few decades or so. Like, all over the world, climate change is affecting people, and is slowly but surely becoming worse and worse. And I just don't think we're not going to be able to go look at our prime ministers or our representatives or our nations and go, well, why didn't you do anything while we sit here and watch the entire world burn down right in front of us? I'm from the millennial generation, and there are things that I'm afraid I'll never be able to see or do because of climate change. Places I won't be able to go because it's degraded, or environmental policies have completely wiped out any type of responsibility that we have towards taking care of our environment. And I really do think that if we don't do anything, like I'm not saying I know what to do. But I do know that doing nothing is the worst possible thing we can do.
Right.
You know, even a person who's read like enough history knows that, like, I just feel like we come down to the same thing. Somebody in power usually come from a background of wealth makes terrible decisions mm-hmm. for everybody, bad things happen.
Yeah,
while we try to get it right and tell them to step down or do something about it, and then they give us all these platitudes and non answers about what they're actually doing.
So, Reggie, I'm going to take it back from you because I definitely hear your frustration in terms of just talking about it or looking to current leadership and holding them responsible isn't enough. And I appreciate that point, Reggie. But Alistair Melzer, let me turn back to you on that because, as you heard earlier in the hour, we were talking to Isabella in Sydney. The New York Times reporter there in Sydney, who said that she felt that Australia may be reaching something of a tipping point in terms of how the people do view their current political leaders there on issues of climate and land management. Now, I know you're an animal expert there, but is that a sense that you're getting? Because the environment is so important for the people of Australia.
It depends where you are in the country. Certainly the sense we're getting now with these fires is that there's been a shift in public sentiment, even in some of the more conservative parts of the country. We're not quite sure how that's going to play out. That's an evolving situation now, and people's responses straight after fires.
Right.
And I can speak from personal experience, is often more, is more emotional than it is in a more considered time. So we've got two more years, really, with this government and with the changing policies that they're going to have to see how that evolves.
I'm going to take it back from you just because I have to take a quick break, but we'll come right back because we are talking about the historic bushfires still burning in Australia and lessons for the rest of the world. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about Australia's historic bushfires and lessons for the rest of the world. I'm joined today by Peter Konowski. He's with us from Canberra, Australia. He's a professor of forestry at the Australian National University's Fenner School of Environment and Society. Alistair Melzer also joins us from Rockhampton, Australia. He's research program leader for koala research at Central Queensland University. And Alistair, before the break, I had asked you a sort of policy level question about attitudes about climate change. And in your answer, you said that when you're in the middle of a catastrophic fire, people's reactions often begin, understandably, with emotion. And you said, speaking from personal experience, what is your personal experience? What were you getting at there?
Okay. First of all, I live in a rural part of Australia, so I'm one of those folk who have, along with my wife, we have our household, our homestead, in the Australian forest. I'm looking out on it now. And so we're constantly aware of the threat of fire to the survival of this property. Our property is also a conservation reserve of a particular type, and we're constantly aware of the need to manage the fire in this landscape as part of that mm-hmm. conservation response. So we've had fire across this property. We've also had other significant environmental impacts, such as Category 5 or close to Category 5 cyclones come through. And when you experience those sorts of things, there is an immediate emotional concern, obviously, for your and your partner's welfare, but also just the responses of the civil authorities at the time as well. You're concerned that you don't have access to resources, there's no communication, it may take a number of days for people to be able to cut their way into your house so you have access to the rest of the world, those sorts of things. So it is normal. I should say I have not had to lose a house. We have not had our house or any of our infrastructure lost, so I can't pretend to be in the same situation as those people who have lost those things. But it's just an emotional situation right. You're in, and that some of it stays with you for quite some time. Yeah. You can get flashbacks and things like that at times as well, which is can be quite distressing.
Well, I'm so glad and grateful that you shared that with us, because Peter, a lot of the anger in terms of what we're reading from reporting coming out of Australia has to do, yes, with climate, but also with more sort of immediately urgent things that the government either has or hasn't done. I mean, Alistair mentioned management, and you were a member of the 2004 National Inquiry on Bushfire Mitigation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Because we had a caller, Joe, unfortunately, who his line dropped on us. But Joe, the caller Joe, wanted to say he didn't believe that the climate change really had much to do with it, but rather he looked at the government's like no cutting policy or the management of the bush in general that is more where fingers should be pointing. What's your response to that?
Well, certainly a contested area, and it's complicated, so I'll try and just explain some of the key factors. Your listeners might be familiar with some of the similar debates from the Western US, where you've had, of course, very severe wildfires for much of the past decade, megafires, and then most recently in California. And the argument is that changes in the management of forests, particularly in the fire regimes, how frequent fires are, the seasons they occur, the intensity of the fire, sort of things Alistair mentioned earlier, that those have changed since European colonisation of North America and Australia, that Indigenous First Nations peoples used fire as a management tool, and that their use of fire was typically much more frequent and a much lower intensity. That doesn't mean that high-intensity fires didn't occur, but they occurred perhaps less frequently than they have since European colonisation displaced First Nations and Indigenous peoples and managed the forests differently. So one of the challenges in post-colonial societies is the interaction between Indigenous and First Nations management of the landscape and the fire regimes that emerged from that, compared to the fire regimes that have begun to emerge since European colonisation and displacement of those peoples. And that's the case in North America as it is in Australia. The other factor in Australia is that we've got a very diverse continent. Alistair also mentioned that. There are different fire regimes, different patterns of fire, different seasons of fire in different parts of Australia. And so it's dangerous to talk about Australia as if it's a sort of uniform whole.
Because that's right. It is a continent, indeed.
In the northern, just like the US, of course. In the northern savannas, over the last decade or so, there's emerged a very progressive co-management regime between Indigenous Australians, Aboriginal people, and fire scientists to reintroduce traditional Indigenous burning into those northern savanna landscapes. And many people have suggested that we should be doing more of that sort of partnership management of our forests in southern Australia. There's a range of reasons why that's more difficult. Southern Australia is more settled, there's more infrastructure and more population, things go wrong, more people get impacted. The forests of southern Australia are quite different terms of tree species composition and density to those of northern Australia. But nevertheless, I think one of the positives to emerge from the discussion so far that reflects some of what's been happening on a relatively small scale in southern Australia is a recognition that working with our Indigenous peoples on their country to look at how they might manage landscapes that they've been displaced from might help inform us about ways that we can manage those forested landscapes better in the future.
Peter, if I may just jump in here, because I only have 2 minutes left with you and Alistair. I mean, you're the analogous situation that we have here in the United States, particularly in the West, is spot on. And the truth is, it's not just climate change and it's not just forest management. We're here because of both of those reasons, right? I mean, we have a climate whose baseline is shifting. We have, you know, a couple of centuries of forest management that or bush management in Australia that creates more tinder, and now it's drier than ever, essentially. And we have people, you know, speaking in the U.S. context, who are living in more fire-prone zones, more people than ever. It's all of the above. Yeah. I just wonder...
That's correct.
The question I was going to turn to you and ask is Australia now, given all of that, facing a future where year upon year, just the danger of these kinds of mega fires is continuously growing?
In a general sense, that's true, but the year-to-year variation will continue. So, for example, in the areas that have burnt this year, there won't be the fuel to burn the same way for at least a decade, probably, and probably a number of decades. In other parts of the landscape that haven't burned this year, there will be. So the challenge for us, I think, is in these new, more extreme conditions that are going to characterise a warmer, drier future. The sorts of approaches to managing fire that we've developed over the last 200 years of European settlement in Australia don't seem to be adequate for the challenges that we face in the future. And I think that's also the experience that you're having, particularly in the Western US and Canada. So we've got to be thinking about different forms of fuel management, different forms of defending people's property, as Alistair referred to before, and different ways of living in this very fire-prone continent.
Yeah. Well, Alistair, in the last couple of seconds that we have, I know a lot of people listening want to know how, if and how they can help Australia at this moment. Do you have any advice on how people can help?
At a grassroots level, certainly. The most immediate needs at the moment are to support those individuals and those groups who are looking at the injured animals or the displaced animals, because they can be used to assist in repopulating, recovering forests that have lost their resident population. That's the most immediate thing that ordinary folk can do. They need that support. The researchers, the folk who are trying to work out how to manage this new situation we're in, they need the resources to get in and understand those processes. Government will provide a lot of that support, but there's also an important need for community support as well, through crowdfunding or simply by donating time as volunteers through organisations such as Earthwatch or other NGO-based ecosystem assistance or research assistance type programs that are around the world. Those things are important. The thing to remember is that we talked about stepwise change in our attitudes. There's been step change in our environment as well. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing a gradual slide to a new situation. In many places, it's a single event that causes a landscape or an ecosystem or a population such as koalas to change to a new level. And we don't know quite what those new steady states will be, if anything. So we're looking at sudden change here and how we as a community can deal with that sudden change is still up in the air.
Well, Alistair Melzer, Research Program Leader for Koala Research at Central Queensland University, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Peter Konowski, Professor of Forestry at the Australian National University's Fenner School of Environment and Society. Peter, thank you as well.
Likewise, Magna, my pleasure.
Well, I want to spend the last couple of minutes in this hour talking about another major issue that's informing how we understand what's happening in Australia right now. And to help us with that, I'm going to welcome my Friday colleague, David Folkenflik, into the conversation right now. Of course, David is host of On Point on Fridays. He's also NPR's media correspondent. Hi there, David.
Hey, Meghna. Been listening.
We're leaning on your expertise here for a very specific reason, and you're one of the most knowledgeable folks there is about Rupert Murdoch, author of Murdoch's World, right? Your 2013 book that examines Murdoch's influence in media. Of course, he's Australian and got his start in Australia's media here, and we've been seeing reports that there's a lot of conservative media in Australia that's sort of downplaying the issue of climate change right now in those fires?
You can't really separate thinking about how the media is handling the immediacy of the crisis and the larger issues that are informing it, as we've been hearing this hour, without thinking about Rupert Murdoch. He currently his company, News Corp, ultimately is the corporate parent of four of the five largest city newspapers in Australia, the largest national newspaper in Australia. It owns Sky News Australia, which is a little less polemically ideological than Fox News, but is certainly of the right and certainly features some of the most conservative voices in Australian public life. And I did stories back when I visited 2011, 2012 in Australia, and it holds true now from what I understand. The coverage of climate change, which of course is a key issue here, has been one that is based much more on the politics than the science, much more quoting people debating policy or just sort of general attitudes towards climate change than about sort of burrowing in to offer explanations and, in fact, overloading it consistently statistically towards people skeptical or denying the climate change science, for which there's an overwhelming consensus that although the details may be in doubt, that the fact of man-driven, that humanity-driven climate change is real. And there's a second element of this too. You have Scott Morrison, whom you've mentioned this hour, the Prime Minister of Australia. He's there in significant, not only, but significant part because of the support of the Murdoch newspapers. You know, Murdoch has this game in Australia that he does in Britain as well, less so in the US, where he supports either center-left candidates from the Labour parties of those two countries to quite conservative candidates of the more conservative party called the Liberal Party in counterintuitively in Australia. But even when they had a person from the more conservative party, Malcolm Trumbull, as prime minister, not sufficiently anti-regulation, not sufficiently skeptical of climate change for the Murdochs, even though publicly they embrace the issue, even though publicly News Corp itself is a fairly green company in its corporate policies, not so on its pages, particularly its editorial pages where so much of its coverage is found.
Right. So I'm seeing here that News Corp is basically saying that they're in statements they've been making, that they've been doing a great job, right? They say, quote, our coverage has recognized Australia is having a conversation about climate change and how to respond to it. But they also say the role of arsonists and policies that may have contributed to the spread of fire are legitimate stories to report on in the public interest. But of course, Australian experts are saying that arsonists may be like a diminishingly small cause of these fires. So is this News Corp's playbook here generally?
Yeah, I think so. It's basically focus on the more micro issues that can be perhaps legitimately scrutinized and sort of move past the more macro questions that really fundamentally Australians believe are important and need to face. I mean, Australia, as you've said, is a very much a coal-focused economy in some ways and is an exporter. And there are all kinds of reasons why it's complicated for them. And at the same time, they are on the front lines of this. Much of the continent is covered with desert. And although the Australian, its national newspaper of News Corp, is capable of very good coverage, so much of what they do on climate change is focused on the opinion pages rather than the news pages because it's a complicated and unwelcome issue for a lot of their readers and for certainly a lot of their political allies. And so much of that coverage that dominates on the editorial pages or the opinion pages are themselves heavily weighted to make it skeptical or even denouncing people as loons, one of their prominent columnists, Terry McCran. So I think it's not serving the people of Australia, even as they can point to individual elements of coverage that are.
And just a couple seconds here, David, but is some of this information or misinformation making its way outside of News Corp outlets?
Sure. Sky News and what the tabloids publish in News Corp-owned properties are very influential for what happens on cable TV, what is discussed on morning television there, and particularly what's discussed on talk radio around the country. So its footprint is much larger than what it actually owns there over there at News Corp Australia.
Well, David Folkenflik, he is our colleague, my colleague and host of NPR. On Point, I keep calling you NPR's On Point, host of On Point on Fridays and NPR's
We've
media correspondent. I should just hand reins over to you now, David, but thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.